Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Latham. Yeah, I just wanted to preempt this episode where Rich and I talk about the second Alfred Hitchcock film titled The Man Who Knew Too Much to once again promote the Journey into Patreon, where I provide extra features as well as early releases of the things that appear here on the main podcast feed. For example, this episode that you're about to listen to has been on Patreon for about a month now. And I just uploaded the latest episode of Outfield Excursions, where Rish and I talk about a recent movie named The Turning, which is based on the novella The Turn of the Screw by Henry James. I've also kind of adjusted the different tiers on Patreon, and I just started a new monthly podcast that's Patreon only, where I talk about Star Trek with Keith Techlitz, where we're going to talk about all of the many Star Trek series kind of in a round robin style, as well as movies and books and other things. So I'm excited about that. And that's at the $3 a month level. And I'm also ramping up the Comics Cave podcast, where I talk about various comic book runs and whatnot. And that'll be at the $5 level. But even at the $1 level, you get extra material as well as early episodes and a monthly personal address. So please head on over to patreon.com/journeyinto and check out what I have to offer there. But enough about that. Let's get on with the show. Hello, and welcome once again to another episode of the Outfield Excursions here on the Journey Into podcast. I'm here once again with Rish Outfield to talk about Alfred Hitchcock's The Man Who Knew Too Much. We didn't get enough of it last time, so here we are again. However, there is a, 23-year gap between the movies that we talked about last time versus this time.
Yeah, there's a big difference. Oh, sorry. Hey, this is Rish Outfield. There's a lot of differences, but what's fun is that there are some similarities too. So I'm glad that we watched the two back to back so we can point at the similarities.
Yeah.
Both of them directed by Alfred Hitchcock, one in 1934 in black and white on a very low budget in Britain. The other one on a big budget in 1956. Paramount Pictures financed this one. It's in Technicolor, in VistaVision, which was, you know, the widescreen format that was invented just to drag people away from their television sets. Yeah, it was shot internationally. I was surprised. They actually shot at the Royal Albert Hall. They actually shot in Marrakesh. And yeah, I guess we can talk about The Man Who Knew Too Much Redux.
Yeah, I've been trying to figure out the best way to go about this. I mean, we went through pretty much all of the plot last time for the 1934 version. And we could just start talking about the plot points that are the same and then talk about the differences. Or we can just start going into, hey, you know the plot, but here's what's different or here's what was added or things like that, but maybe the best thing is to just give a quick description of the basic plot element from the 1934 movie, kind of a recap
of the 34 version.
Yes, of the 1934 version.
Okay, you're wanting me to do that, or you have a plan?
I don't have anything prepared, but I could take a crack at it, or if you want to go for it, go ahead.
No. You go ahead. I remember the new one way better. And isn't it funny? I'm calling it the new one, even though it's it's what, 70 years old?
Yeah. Let's see. I'll try to be as generic as possible so that we can see the similarities here. So, in the 1934 movie, The Man Who Knew Too Much, we had a husband and wife with their child who were traveling abroad. They were in Switzerland, but they lived in London. And they made a friend with a man named Louis Bernard. And he was killed, but as he was dying, he revealed that he had information on an assassination plot
of global proportions. And this family, particularly the husband, got directly involved in this plot, this assassination plot, or he was dragged into the middle of it. Their child was kidnapped, and the husband and wife could not tell the authorities the information that they had, and they had to do what they could to decipher the clues and find their child themselves. They went to London. They found clues that led them to a church where the child was being held. The father got taken captive. They learned that the assassination was going to take place at the Albert Hall in London. And the wife character ended up going to the hall, met the assassin, and figured out how he was going to kill the diplomat at the concert. And there was a specific cue in the music that was going to be played when the cymbals crashed. That was when the diplomat was going to be shot. And the woman screamed at that just before that time and was able to distract the assassin enough to save the life of the diplomat. And then eventually they were able to rescue their child from the kidnappers. And everything was happy in the end. Without the details, I guess that was the generic plot of the movie that we talked about last time we got together. In essence, that's the same thing that happens in this movie, but there's a lot of interesting diversions and differences in locale and character bits. And so I think it'll be a lot of fun to talk about this movie with that background, knowing the basic premise of the movie, to kind of talk about the things that made this or the other movie better, or things we liked in either one. Is there anything that jumps to your mind first out the gate?
Well, yeah. It is the cast, obviously. Now, the husband and wife are played by Jimmy Stewart and Doris Day. Stewart plays Ben McKenna. He's a doctor, a surgeon. Doris Day is his wife, Jo McKenna, who is a retired pop singer, I guess. She was a famous singer, yeah, and she gave up her career to be a mother, I guess, to move out to, is it Philadelphia somewhere?
Indianapolis, I believe.
Indianapolis, that sounds right. And be a wife, I guess. And she used to have a very glamorous life, it sounds like, but she left that all behind, and you can tell that it still has a pull on her. And then they have a son who is Hank?
Hank, yep. Yeah, in the earlier movie, it was a daughter, so that was different as well.
And yeah, this was the third of four movies that James Stewart did for Hitchcock. Can you name the four movies?
Rope, Rear Window, The Man Who Knew Too Much, and Vertigo.
Well, you even did it in chronological order. Impressive. Hitch always cast Stewart because he was the everyman, because the men in the audience could see themselves in James Stewart. And there is just a quality of, there's a quality of decency to him, but not of daring do or immense bravery, or he doesn't have like the what Cary Grant had, where all eyes would turn and look at Cary Grant if he came in the room. Stewart is just, yeah, he's an average guy, but you know, maybe a nicer than average, more decent than average guy. And yeah, it's really just those two that the whole movie rests on. They sort of trade off as to who is in control of the action. I mean, it's more Stewart's movie than Doris Day, but there are long stretches when it just becomes her movie.
It does,
and
yeah.
They just hand her the microphone and say, okay, go ahead. And I thought that was interesting. It's 1950s, and we always think of the 1950s as being the time when women had the least agency, when you know, being a housewife was considered the epitome of what was expected. when the woman in the first one, in the 1934 one, shoots the guy that's about to attack her daughter because she was a sharpshooter or whatever, that felt revolutionary to
me. It did, yeah.
You know, it's just like, wow, that's astounding. Because they established that in the very first scene that she was a sharpshooter, and it pays off at the very end. She grabs a rifle from a policeman who is unwilling to take the shot because what if he misses? I thought that that was really neat. And yeah, you get a lot of really good acting on Doris Day's part. I only knew her from... this is going to sound really bad, but what they would call them in the 1940s and 50s were women's pictures. You know, with lots of banter and a wedding at the end and maybe a song or two and bright colors. And that's how I knew Doris Day. You know, she's in Pillow Talk with Rock Hudson.
Or, yeah.
You know, Don't Eat the Daisies. Stuff like that. And yet I really felt like she acted... like her acting ability was out front and memorable in this. She was really, really good.
She was. Yeah. And, you know, the other movies that I associate her with are just, you know, the song and dance movies where, you know, they need a little plot to keep the movie going, but it's pretty much one musical number to the next, you know, those types of movies. She did a lot of those as well.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm not familiar with any of those. Because I didn't have older sisters and my mom has always hated musicals.
Mm.
But I believe you. Okay, so the movie begins and they're in Marrakesh. It's Jimmy Stewart and Doris Day and their little boy. And the little boy is precocious and fun and he speaks his mind. They've obviously got a very close family. I'd say the kid is like 10 or 11. Maybe, I don't know, how old would you say he is?
Yeah, maybe 9 or 10, somewhere in there, yeah.
They're on vacation. I feel like Jimmy Stewart's character has taken them on this trip abroad to show them where he served in the war. And then they're just sort of sightseeing on their way back. And then they're going to go to London to end the trip, right?
Well, I think they
went to Casablanca. Sorry, go.
Well, I was going to say they might have started in London and then went to Morocco or Casablanca, Morocco, and then ended in Marrakesh. And I think they went back to London because they knew that's where the assassination was going to happen.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that. But they're on a bus and they meet this man. He's a Frenchman. And you are always able to remember their names. Is it the same name?
It is. Yeah. His character has the same name.
So it's Louis Bernard.
Yes.
And he takes a real shine to them and he just sits down and he starts asking them all these questions. And Jimmy Stewart is telling him all about his life and his service and what he does. And Joe, the wife, is suspicious. She doesn't think that he should be telling the stranger all these things. And it makes sense. But the Frenchman is just a nice guy. He says, when we get back to the hotel, let me take you out to dinner. And they get to the hotel, and this is where we get our first musical number of Que Sera Sera, which was written for this movie, Academy Award winning best song
yes.
of 1956.
Second verse. When I was just a child in school, I asked my teacher, what should I try?
Catch.
Joe is singing it, and her son knows the song as well. He's like whistles along to it.
Wise reply.
Que sera, sera. Whatever will be. The future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera. Oops.
What will be, will be.
I just remember being a little boy. I was not much older than Hank when I first saw this and just thinking that the song was really neat and both of my parents knew it. And there's a knock at the door. And it's Reggie Nalder. And when the door opened, I was just like, oh, Reggie Nalder! I wish that there was a drop that you could play, like some kind of sound effect every single time that we see Reggie Nalder, because he's so terrifying. And I know him from a bunch of horror movies. He made a bunch, but most people know him from this, or from the Star Trek episode Journey to Babel, where he plays the phony Andorian.
Ah, okay.
Do you remember the Andorians? They're the blue-skinned guys. And it turns out, Captain, he is not an Andorian at all. He's the assassin, or the guy that frames Spock's father for murder on the Enterprise. But you'd never recognize him because he's blue-skinned and white-haired in Star Trek. But Reggie Nalder is unmistakable because he was burned, severely burned when he was a young man. And so he's got like this frightening visage. They're just the guy always played bad guys. He always played monsters or mad scientists or devils, or he played Dracula in Zoltan, Hound of Dracula. And so when they answer the door and he's standing there, you get this zoom in on him and just like this terrifying music where you just, you know, this guy is trouble. They didn't have to play the zoom. They didn't have to play the music. They didn't have to zoom in. Reggie Nalder's face alone is enough to show you this guy is bad. If you ever saw the Toby Hooper Salem's Lot miniseries, he was the head vampire that looked like Nosferatu.
Oh, okay.
And they didn't have to do any makeup at all. Those are his real fingers and real white eyes and real pointed ears. So anyway, I'm going to let you talk for a minute, but I just wanted to introduce Reggie Nalder because he's a face only his mother could love.
Well, that's really cool because, yeah, I mean, I recognized him from this movie, but I didn't know of his other appearances and kind of that fame that he had. So that's kind of cool to know that. But yeah, so he knocks on the door and Joe answers it, and there's a weird exchange that, you know, he kind of looks behind her and sees Louis in the background, and they both look back at Louis, and Louis just kind of standing there. It's just kind of an odd moment. There must be a connection there or something. And he says, "Oh, I'm sorry. I was looking for some name." Says, "Oh no, they're not here." He's like, "Okay, I'm sorry to bother you," and then he's gone. And so we know something's going on with that. And then Louis gets a phone call, starts talking, you know, in a different language on the phone, and then excuses himself, says, "Sorry, I'm not going to be able to go to dinner with you. We'll have to do this another time," and kind of abruptly leaves. And this, of course, just lends more credence to Joe's suspicions of him. And so then they go down and eat by themselves. When they first got to the hotel, as they were walking in, there was this other couple that was leaving the hotel, and the woman was kind of looking at them very strangely. And, you know, Joe at that time said, "Yeah, we're being watched." And, you know, of course, Jimmy Stewart was just kind of like, "Ah, you know, don't worry about it. You're thinking too much about it." But this same couple is sitting behind them at the restaurant, and she notices them looking at them again.
"Those people are staring at us."
"What people?"
"Right in back of us."
"What?"
"Yes."
"Here."
"They were staring at us in front of the hotel, too."
"Joe, will you please stop imagining things?"
"I'm not." "Good evening."
"Dinner.
You must think me awfully rude. I've been staring at you ever since I saw you at the hotel. You are Joe Conway. The Joe Conway?"
"Oh, yes, I am.
Didn't I tell you I knew I was right? I'm Lucy Drayton, and this is my husband."
"How do you do?"
How do you do?
"We're Dr. and Mrs. McKenna. My wife tells me Mrs. McKenna appeared at the London Palladium a few years ago."
"Of course, we hardly ever see a show now. Edward is such an old stick in the mud, so I have to console myself with your records."
"Oh. And I must admit, I love them. I'm not one for this terrible bebop."
"When are you coming back to London?"
"Possibly never again, professionally."
"Oh, don't say you're giving up the stage."
"Well, temporarily, I am."
"Well, it's just that I'm a doctor, and you know a doctor's wife never has much time."
"What my husband is trying to say is that Broadway musical shows are not produced in Indianapolis, Indiana."
"Well, no.
Of course, we could."
Eventually, they eat together and get to know each other, and this couple are the Draytons, Lucy and Edward Drayton. And they invite them to go into town tomorrow to spend the day together. And so they agreed to do that, even though they did have plans with Louis. But they had seen Louis come in the restaurant with another woman and go sit at a different table in another area of the restaurant. And so they were kind of put out by that and figured, well, we don't need to go out with him. We'll go with the Draytons. And so the next day they're out with the Draytons and they're out in Marrakesh and they're seeing all the different sites and all the different shops. And Hank is kind of hanging out a lot with Mrs. Drayton. And this is when we see the police chasing somebody through the streets of Marrakesh. And it appears to be a dark-skinned man running from the police. And you know, we see him run through the streets and fall into some paint. Then we see him get stabbed in the back. And then he makes his way. The knife is still in his back. And he kind of crawls his way through the streets. And he ends up going up to the McKennas and the Draytons that are standing there. He kind of falls on Jimmy Stewart. You know, Jimmy Stewart tries to help him. And he kind of slides down. And his face is actually full of makeup to give him the dark skin. And that kind of wipes off on Jimmy Stewart's hands, and he falls to the ground. And then he calls him. He says, it's Louis Bernard. And so Jimmy Stewart bends down and tries to help him. And then Louis whispers in his ear and tells him about, we don't hear everything he says, just a couple little words. And then he dies. And Jimmy Stewart stands up and asks his wife for a piece of paper, and he writes down what Louis had told him and puts it back in her purse or whatever. And so again, it's similar to what we had in the earlier movie. But I think you said the stabbing happened. This scene happens about 30 minutes into the movie. Where in the 1934 version, you know, it was like in the first 5 minutes of the movie. And if, you know, this is a much longer movie, but, we have a lot more development here, a lot more, we know these characters a lot more, Dr. McKenna and Joe and their son. And it just kind of gives more of a platform so that we know and care about these characters. And it probably has to do again with, it's an American movie made for an American audience. And they, you know, it's kind of using the conventions of the 1950s more than, you know, the British film back in the 1930s. But I appreciate that, getting to know the characters a little bit more. But this is kind of the inciting incident. This is what drives us into the plot. And then from here, it really starts, you know, going into the thriller, into the suspense, and trying to figure out how to get out of this and what's going on.
Yeah, so the police take Jimmy Stewart and Doris Day in, and they're questioning them. And there is some hostility there, but at the same time, he doesn't show them what he wrote down. I think they're aware that they had some kind of interchange, and the authorities want to know what the dead man said. And Jimmy Stewart gives that same, you know, stuff that you hear, that you still hear today. It's like, well, I'm an American citizen, and I, you know, I have my rights. You can't treat me like this kind of thing. And there's a telephone call for him, and the police chief says, you know, when he's done with his questioning, he can, and he's like, no, I'm going to answer it right now. And he goes, he picks up the phone, and there's a voice, and it says, if you keep quiet about what Mr. Bernard said to you, no harm will come to your son. And at this moment, there's a moment very, very similar in the first movie. But because of the pacing in this one, you feel it a lot more. I mean, you get to know everybody, just like you said, better. You get to know the relationship. There's a ton more dialogue. you've got a much broader canvas in a 2-hour movie than you did in, I'll bet the 1934 one was like 75 minutes long. But, you know, he has to go in there and not say anything. But I know that he calls the hotel to check on his boy.
Well, yeah, because Mrs. Drayton had said, well, I'll take Hank back with me. You don't want him hanging out at the police office. So I'll take Hank back to the hotel. And then Mr. Drayton went with them to the police office.
Yeah, Drayton is so helpful and nice. And he speaks French. And Jimmy Stewart doesn't, and so he offers to translate. We see him translate a great deal, but I guess he's not so nice. Because, yeah, he calls, Jimmy Stewart calls the hotel, and he wants to talk to Mrs. Drayton, and she's not there. And he's starting to realize that she had something to do with this kidnapping. And so he has to go and say, we're done here. We're going to go back to our hotel. And he doesn't tell Joe right away. This was a really interesting scene from a 21st century perspective.
I thought so too, yeah.
He's a doctor. And so he says, honey, I want you to take this because it's going to calm you down. And she's like, why? Why do I need to be calm? I'm fine. And he says, well, I want you to just do as I say. He gives her this tranquilizer, basically. And then says, okay, are you calm? So here's the thing. Our boy has been kidnapped. Mrs. Drayton said she was on her way back here, but she never came here. And her husband just checked out by himself and they're gone. And they got on a plane. They're gone with our boy. And she does not take this well. Oh my gosh. It was really a hard scene to watch. Because she's super upset and super worried, but she's also furious at him for not telling her. And for this tranquilizing thing, it is really difficult to put my mind back to this being okay in the 1950s. And I don't know that it was. That, you know, my mom, if she watched this in 1956, if she would have been like, oh, or if that was just expected, that the man would take charge and his wife was going to be hysterical, and to keep her from flying into hysterics, he would drug her. We've talked about that recently with the, you know, you can't have a man slap a woman to calm her down anymore in the 21st century. It is not acceptable. And this felt like one of those things that was a product of its time, but is no longer acceptable. Did you feel the same way? Did you watch it with your wife?
Parts of it. I don't remember if she was there for that scene or not. But yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know how it played to the audience in 1956. But, you know, I do remember that you did see that portrayal a lot of the hysterical woman, you know, that they lost reason or whatever. And, you know, I know that was a stereotype and a, you know, wrong depiction of women in the 1950s. But that was a very strong trope, I think, in movies and TV shows at the time. And, well, you still see it today, you know, where the screaming woman, yeah, you know, where nobody in real life would really scream like that in a lot of cases. But you still have the screaming woman in a lot of things. And like you said, she was angry with him for giving her the sleeping pills or whatever as well. She forgave him for it later. I mean, it wasn't a plot point after that point. But yeah, it was kind of a strange thing to watch.
Right. She goes to sleep. It knocks her out. And he packs up all of their stuff while she's out, right?
Yeah. And then when she wakes up, he kind of talks to her and tells her what the plan is. But she's still kind of out of it a little bit. And he says, okay, now it's almost time for you to, you know, you need to start getting up and doing things.
Yeah. And the plan is that they're going to go to London. And I think it's because he tells her that what Bernard said before he died was that someone, a diplomat, was going to be assassinated in London. And he gives him some information, including the words, the name, Ambrose Chapel.
Right.
And that's on the piece of paper. So the doctor decides that they're going to go to London. And I believe also that we find out that the Draytons in their private jet flew to London. So we know that that's where the boy is. So they fly to London and the plane lands and there's this big crowd. And it reminded me of that scene in The Naked Gun when the plane lands and Frank Drebin comes out and there's this huge crowd and they're all cheering. And he's like, wow, thank you. Thank you. I'm all in a day's work. And they're like, no, Frank. Weird Al Yankovic was on the plane. And it's like that. There's this big crowd, but they're all there for Joe. And that was really strange to me. And they show this woman. It is it's as jarring as the Reggie Nalder shot at the doorway. There's this this on location shot of this big crowd at the airport in London. And then there's an insert that is not shot at the airport of a woman with glasses and like a brown hair. And it just, it is not something that you would do today because it's just so jarring. And every time they show this woman, you want to hear like a sting of scary music. Like it's a jump scare in a Blumhouse horror film. And she goes to a payphone and calls, and Mrs. Drayton answers. Or is it Mrs. Drayton, or is it? No, it's not Mrs. Drayton. It's like the preacher woman, the whatever you would call, the woman in the church, right? She calls and says, you know, they just landed here in London. And so we know that this woman is involved in the conspiracy.
Right.
But Ben and Joe don't see this woman. They just see a bunch of reporters and stuff that are like, oh, are you coming out of retirement? Are you going to perform? Et cetera, et cetera. And they're taken aside immediately by Scotland Yard, by some, I'll call him an inspector, but, you know, it sounds like he already knows everything that's going on. And this was the only scene that I didn't think really worked in the movie. Because he tells them everything that you have just seen in the last 30 minutes of the movie. And I wondered why that scene was in there. Are there people that are just getting to the theater now? But he knows everything. And he knows that the boy has been kidnapped and that they have been told not to say anything. And he wants to know what Bernard told them before he died. And Jimmy Stewart understandably doesn't want to share that. And he's like, oh, I don't know what you're talking about. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, Inspector Buchanan was his name. I'm just looking at it. That's why I know.
Okay.
But yeah, he kind of played the part of the Agent Gibson or whatever in the 1934 movie from the Foreign Offices. and so, yeah, he was the basically the inspector that knew everything and wanted to help them. But of course, they couldn't ask for his help because then that would put their boy in danger.
Well, let me interrupt here for a second and just talk to you about you being a father. Obviously, you put yourself in Jimmy Stewart's shoes, right?
Yeah.
Did you ask yourself what I would do in this situation? And the police, this guy wants to help. And it sounds like he knows a lot. But Jimmy Stewart still doesn't tell him anything. He doesn't share what he knows. Was that understandable to you? Would you have done the same thing?
I don't know. I mean, I typically would trust the authorities and say, hey, we can't let them know that, you know, that I told you anything, but here's what's going on. What can we do? You know, how can you help us and, you know, make sure that our boy doesn't get killed? Yeah, I guess it would depend on how threatening or how much credence I gave to the threat to my son. How did they, I think in the first movie, you know, it was obvious that they knew what was going on. They were on watch or whatever, that they were being watched. Everything they did was known. And so I think it was a little bit more believable that they wouldn't work with the authorities. But yeah, here it's not as much.
Well, these people have already murdered somebody in public, surrounded by dozens, if not hundreds of people. So I think Jimmy Stewart has to know these guys mean business.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? His son is in mortal danger. They're not bluffing. There's a scene in the first movie where they say, you know, what if there was an assassination? What if you could have prevented the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand and prevented the Great War from happening? And the guy says, you know, well, our daughter means more to us than any politician or any ambassador. There wasn't a parallel like that in this, where they say, you know, that one person's life is worth more than another person. But Jimmy Stewart, when they get back to the hotel, says, look, let's find this Ambrose Chapel person, and I'll tell him I'll keep my mouth shut. I won't tell the police anything as long as they don't hurt our boy. We'll give him money. I'm a surgeon. I have money. You probably have money from your singing career. We'll offer them money and maybe we'll get our boy back and we won't say anything. We won't get involved in this assassination plot. I liked that a lot. And that seems like something that a parent would do, would say, yeah, it's unfortunate that they're going to kill somebody, but that's not really my concern. My concern is my boy.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where there's a series of scenes that they set up in that moment that I just love the little asides that happen in this movie. When they were in Marrakesh and they were at the restaurant eating, you know, there was this whole thing where, you know, the tables are really low and you sit down on these cushions, and Jimmy Stewart had a hard time getting comfortable in that situation. And you know, it's just kind of a little aside thing, but I thought that was a lot of fun. And then in this scene, when he's going to call, they're looking through the phone book and he's going to call Ambrose Chapel. And then this group of people come in their room, you know, knock on the door and come in, and they're all friends of Joe, or, you know, people that she's known in London. And they all come in the room and basically, you know, invade their room and are going to have they want to have a little party with Joe or whatever. And he's on the phone. He's trying to find out about Ambrose. So it's kind of an awkward moment for Jimmy Stewart. And then, you know, as the movie progresses, they come back and forth to this room and all these people are still there. And I just love that whole setup. It's just this whole other little movie going on within the bigger movie, and it doesn't have any impact on the plot at all, but it's just these little comedic moments with this group of people in their hotel room. And I thought that was a lot of fun. And there's a big payoff at the end that we'll talk about, but
yeah, very briefly, while she's entertaining these friends, he slips away. He calls Ambrose Chapel and says, what's your address? Can I meet you there? I'm on my way. And so he goes there, and it's a taxidermy shop, and it's just filled with all these animal heads and bodies and a bunch of people. And anyway, Jimmy Stewart goes in there thinking that this is the mastermind. This is the guy that has his kid. And Ambrose Chapel comes out, and he's an old man. He says he's in his 70s, but he looks older than that. And Jimmy Stewart says, well, I are you the guy that I'm here to talk to? I don't. And the old man says, no, I know who you're here for. Ambrose. And he's got a younger son who's still not young, also named Ambrose Chapel. And he comes out, and Jimmy Stewart gives him this speech. And I loved this scene. It was so, so good, because this guy has no idea what Jimmy Stewart is saying.
Exactly what had you in mind?
Well, you want to talk here?
Certainly.
We have no secrets from our employees.
Okay. Now, in the first place, I haven't uttered one word of what Bernard told me before he died, and I never will. Frankly, I'm not interested in political intrigue. I don't care who you fellows are going to kill here in London. All I want's that boy, and I'll take the next airplane back to America. Oh, come on, please, listen to me, will you? Honestly, if money means anything to you, I'll do...
Father, call the police, quick. Now, sir, shall we go into this a little more carefully?
Wait just a minute. You told him to call the police.
No.
What's the idea trying to bluff me?
Wait just a minute, sir. There can be no...
Let me go.
Are you sure you don't know Louis Bernard?
I've never heard of him.
You've got no idea what happened yesterday in Marrakesh or where my boy is?
Of course not.
Where is he? William Edgar Davis, help!
He starts to, like, manhandle this guy. And, like, all of the employees rush to this guy's assistance, and the father is going to call the police. And when he's going to call the police, that's when Jimmy Stewart realizes that he is in the wrong place and that these guys have no idea what's going on with his son. He went to the wrong place. It's like it was a wild goose chase is how he calls it. And he's lucky that he doesn't get arrested. He apologizes. He goes out in the street. And luckily they're British, so they just, you know, dust themselves off and then go back to their taxidermy work. But that scene was so cool.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun because, and then there was this whole setup when, because, you know, people grabbed him because, you know, like you said, he was going after this Ambrose guy. And so other people working in the taxidermy shop, you know, grabbed him. And there was this whole fight where he was struggling to get free. And there was this swordfish in the taxidermy shop, and the old guy grabs the swordfish, and he's kind of trying to get it out of the way. And, you know, at one point, Jimmy Stewart's hand gets shoved into a lion's mouth, you know, or something like that. And just a lot of fun little things in that scene as well. But Joe, back in the hotel room, figures out that it wasn't a person they were looking for. It was a place. It was an actual chapel, a church. Ambrose Chapel was a place. And so, you know, with her friends, they look it up in the phone book, and then she goes off and she says, if my husband comes back, you know, tell him where I'm at and everything. And so she goes off and she finds the church, and she finds something to let her know that something suspicious is going on there. And eventually she calls back and Jimmy Stewart is back in the hotel room. She gets on the phone with him and she says, here's where I'm at. Come to the chapel. And so then he takes off. And again, these people are in the room just kind of looking at each other like, what's going on here? And he meets her there and they go in the chapel. And again, here's another similarity with the earlier movie where it's not the, what was it? The sun cult or whatever, sun worshiper cult or anything. It was just a regular church. But Jimmy Stewart and Doris Day go into the church and they kind of slide in the back and people are singing a hymn. I was going to look at the other movie and see if it was the same hymn that was being sung, because it was a very similar type of song that was being sung. And they go into the back of the chapel and they're kind of checking things out. And then they see Lucy Drayden going through the congregation with the donation plate, and they realize, oh shoot, she's going to recognize us. And so they try to slide into the back, or even further in the back, you know, off to the side. But eventually she comes to their row and she sees them, and they, you know, they're just looking right at her accusingly. And she's kind of surprised and freaking out and goes back up. And her husband is the preacher, is the priest. And she tries to show him that they're there, but he can't see them because he's behind a post in the chapel. And so he doesn't realize that they're there. And he starts giving his sermon, and somehow he does see them and realizes. And so he makes his sermon really short and kind of says, okay, well, these are things we need to think about. And why don't you go home and think about those things right now? And everybody leaves the chapel except, oh, I missed a part. Jimmy Stewart tells his wife, he says, you need to go call the police and have them surround this place. And so she leaves the chapel, and that's when he recognizes her. Mr. Drayden recognizes her leaving the chapel, and that's when he finishes up the sermon, and everybody leaves, and then the only person left is Jimmy Stewart. I was kind of disappointed that they didn't start throwing chairs at each other like they did in the first movie. Jimmy Stewart gets captured at this point, and By the time Doris Day comes back with the police, everything's locked up tight. Nobody's around. But she calls Scotland Yard. She tries to get a hold of the inspector, and he's not there. He's gone to Albert Hall. You know, she's like, well, he said he would help us if we needed anything, and I need his help more than anything right now. And so the guy does send some guys out to help her, but they can't get in. And she's like, well, can't you bust your way in? And she's like, well, there's warrants and the proper way to do things here. And so they're no help. And eventually they get called off to leave. And she's kind of stuck by herself. But she says, can you drop me off at Albert Hall? And so she goes off by herself there, which leads us to the famous Albert Hall scene from both movies.
Before we get to that, there is a scene where they establish that Reggie Nalder is the assassin. And that it's exactly as the first movie. They're going to be performing this song. And it was a song that was written for the original movie. And they're doing the same song in this one. And there's a big cymbal crash at the very end of the song. And if he shoots the ambassador during that cymbal crash, no one will know that there was a gunshot. And they play the record exactly the same as they did in the first one. You know, it was like right here. And then the big crash at the very end of the song. And I love that. And the movie begins with them performing this while the credits are rolling, I think. And you see the guy with the cymbals just sitting there waiting for his turn at the very end of the song. He does nothing until the very end of the song. He gets out his cymbals and then crashes them together in the last second of the tune. And so that's what they're setting up is going to happen here. And that was just really, really cool. The Royal Albert Hall scene is so good. It is the best sequence in this whole movie for me, as far as what Hitchcock does best, which is convey tension and suspense and the threat of violence through music and camera angles. And I guess I'll let you describe that whole scene, but it is really, really good. And it's really long. Whereas in the short black and white version, all of it, everything was much more, I mean, you could say it's cut back. You could say that, you know, it's much more economical if you don't like a 2-hour movie. But this scene, it really paid off because you hear the whole song and it takes Doris Day a while to figure out what's happening.
Yeah, it does. She does meet up with the assassin and he says, oh, your boy is very lovely or whatever. You know, I met your boy. He's a very nice boy, whatever. And so she realizes, you know, that he's there and she recognizes him from Marrakesh. And she does see the inspector, but ends up going in to the concert hall, even though she doesn't have a ticket. She says, oh, I'm just looking for someone.
And they let her in. They never give her a hard time.
They don't. Yeah. And then, so I was looking this up earlier tonight. It's Storm Clouds Cantata is the song that's played. And like you said, it's played in both movies. Yeah, you just, you know that the song is going, there's a volume to it in this one, in this movie, more so than in the other one. I think they're actually in Albert Hall this time. They weren't in the 1934 movie. They did a lot of photography tricks to make you believe that you're in this bigger room, which is kind of neat in the 1934 movie. But I think this one, I mean, it was all live. It was Bernard Herrmann who was actually conducting the choir and the orchestra, which I thought was kind of cool. And I remember as she gets dropped off and in front of Albert Hall, there's this huge billboard that says Bernard Herrmann. So I thought that was kind of neat too, that he got some billing there because he's done a lot of Hitchcock movies. But anyway, like you said, the whole scene just builds the tension. She's figuring things out. She sees where the assassin is sitting and she saw the prime minister, who's going to be assassinated, sit down and you know, so very, very similar, but like you said, better done in this movie where the tension's building and she kind of figures out where everything's at. Meanwhile, Dr. McKenna, Jimmy Stewart, escapes from the church and makes his way to the hall as well. And he eventually gets there and he sees his wife and he goes and talks to her, but it's all, you can't hear them talking. You just see what they're doing with the music in the background. And she, you know, explains what's happening and who's going to be assassinated. And so he tries to go warn the prime minister, but he kind of gets shooed away by all the guards and the security for that. And so he goes around to all the different boxes because the assassin is up in a box seat and so is the prime minister. And so Jimmy Stewart goes around to each little door and looks in to find him. And he's trying to get there before the shot happens. And like you said, you know, the whole time you're watching this cymbal player and he's just sitting there waiting for his turn. And you look at his music sheet and it's got a bunch of blank stuff until the end where it says cymbals, which was kind of neat. And, you know, he stands up and he's getting ready. And eventually he grabs his cymbals and he's ready to put it together. All while it's... And she's watching. She's worried about everything down below. And Jimmy Stewart's up above trying to find the assassin. And just like in the first movie, just as the cymbals are crashing, she screams, which distracts the assassin a little bit. He shoots the prime minister, but he just gets him in the arm. Jimmy Stewart finds him in the box seat, comes in, and the guy tries to run away from him by hopping from box seat to box seat, and he falls down into the audience and is killed there in Albert Hall. And I thought that was really exciting and fun to watch, too, that not only did you have Joe in the crowd knowing what was going to happen, but you had Jimmy Stewart trying to stop it. And that just the music builds and that whole scene is classic, right? I mean, that's that's why it's a classic movie, a classic scene, and it's pulled off really well.
Yeah, well, I figured like this is the end of the movie, but it's not. The movie still has another 25 minutes or so to go. The prime minister thanks Joe for screaming, you know, saving his life. And he says, you know, if there's anything I can do. And she's just worried about her son, obviously. And there's a reunion between Joe and Ben. The mastermind, the guy that's behind the whole assassination thing, he finds out that it failed. And he's super upset. And he says, well, you know, we need to leave then. But that little boy can identify us. So you need to kill him.
Right, because they freaked out when they were found at the chapel. And so they took the boy out of the chapel and brought him over to the embassy.
Oh, to the foreign embassy. Yeah, because they had wanted to assassinate their own prime minister.
Right. The ambassador wanted to kill the prime minister. And so they take the boy to the embassy to get him away from the chapel so that they can't be found there.
That's right. I think Joe and her husband tell the Scotland Yard guy, tell the police what's going on. And the policeman says, you know, we can't do anything at the embassy. It's foreign soil. You know, we have no authority over that. And we've heard that a bunch of times. I've always found that interesting, that idea. But they have an idea that they have an open invitation from the prime minister, whose life she just saved, that if they call him and sort of invite themselves, they give the excuse that they're leaving London the next day. And so, of course, the prime minister says, oh, come to the embassy and we'll have a little soiree in your honor. And I like this moment where they don't let us in on entirely their plan. But Joe says, what if they don't ask? And he says, in all the times you've gone somewhere, have they ever not asked? And so it's the same day and they go to the embassy, just those two. And they're having this big get together. And among them is the mastermind of the conspiracy, the failed assassination, right?
Yes. Yep.
And yeah, then we've got that moment that I was describing before where it says, you know, the boy can't identify us. He's a witness. He has to die. And I think he tells Dr. Drayton to do it. And Mrs. Drayton goes, no. And which I thought was really nice because she's been taking care of the boy this whole time. And obviously she has become affectionate toward him. She's the more benign of the kidnappers. Right. So they arrive and I don't know how. Well, it's this really great moment, right? Where he, the ambassador is asking a question and it's not, will you like to sing a song? And Jimmy Stewart says, oh, of course she'll sing a song. Of course. I, you know, he just sort of invites themselves to perform. And this scene was also really neat because they gather all these chairs. You know, it's not something that was planned. It's just like a spur of the moment. Okay, now we're going to have a little presentation by this American vocalist. And you can tell that there are people that do not want to watch this, that are not impressed by the song. And that, I felt, was really amusing. There are people that are just kind of like, oh, that's quaint. Oh, this song is going on too long. Jo sits down at the piano and she starts doing Que Sera Sera. And it's it's just a ploy so that all the attention is focused on her and so that Ben will get a chance to look for his son, right?
Yes. And he takes forever to leave the room. I kept saying, she's on the third verse. You better get out of the room. Go find your son.
Yeah, the song is unbelievably long. It probably has like 9 verses, even though we only ever hear 3. Or maybe there's a fourth verse there. But yeah, so he's looking, and I guess it's a very big place. But luckily, Hank hears his mom singing Que Sera Sera downstairs. And he says, that's my mother. And Mrs. Drayton says, is it really? Are you sure? Well, then, can you whistle? And that was established early on in the Marrakesh scene. He can whistle, and very loudly. Yes.
And so, yeah, they hear him. She even stops playing the piano for a second when she hears him whistling. But then she carries on with the song. And Jimmy Stewart is able to get an idea of where he's at. And so he finally gets out of the room. And he goes up the stairs to find his son. And eventually he does. He finds the room where his son is at and he grabs Hank and Hank's crying and he's, you know, he's happy to see his dad, wants to go with him. And Mrs. Drayton is like, you need to leave right now. Get out of here now while you can. They're going to kill him. Or I don't know if she says they're actually going to kill him, but you know, she's very adamant. You need to get out of here now. Leave as fast as you can. And they're just about to leave the room when Mr. Drayton comes back and he's got a gun.
I don't think you're going to do any shooting, Drayton. Not with these people downstairs and the police outside. You're not in a very happy position yourself, you know.
You've got to let the boy go.
Precisely what I'm thinking, my dear. Now, I'm sure you're going to be sensible and help me out of here.
Don't ask me for help, you miserable...
You wouldn't want your father to get hurt, would you, Hank? Now we're going to walk downstairs together, quite casually, like 3 old friends. And then we're going to take a little stroll as far as the nearest taxi rank. And I hope there won't be any emotional scenes on the way down.
Do as he says, Hank.
Jimmy Stewart's trying to make sure his son is calm and says, okay, now, son, let's do what he says and let's go down the hall. So you start going down the hall and... So they go down the hall and start going down the stairs and just kind of a slow, you know, meanwhile, the song is still going on.
And I think she's on her second song.
Oh, that's true. It does change songs. That's true. And now I'm drawing a blank.
Well, they're coming down the stairs and I think Ben slugs Mr. Drayton.
Yeah, something distracts him, I think. And then, yeah, he pushes him down the stairs, essentially. And the gun goes off while he's falling down the stairs. And so Mr. Drayton is dead. And everybody, you know, stops and comes out. and is working on him. And he just, him and Hank just kind of go down the stairs and avoid all the hoopla. And then they find Joe and they're happy. They're all together. And then I don't think there's anything else in that scene, but then the very last scene of the movie, you have Ben and Joe and Hank come back to their hotel room and all the people that have been there are asleep. And they wake up when they come in the room and he says, "Oh, I'm sorry to keep you waiting, but we had to go find our son, Hank." And then it's the end of the movie. I thought that was a kind of a fun way to end it with all the tension that had been going on. Now that we kind of end on this little comedic note. I like that quite a bit. So
yeah, I did too. It was a funny little note. And we had forgotten because it had been so long since we had seen the hotel room. And the idea that all these party guests would have just gone to sleep at somebody's hotel room is so amusing and just nonsensical. But yeah, it made for this just a very funny moment when they come in with their boy, the three of them, and then the credits roll.
I really, really enjoyed this movie. I forgot how much I enjoyed it. I guess, you know, I've seen it a couple times, but it's been a while. But it was a lot of fun to watch this movie and to compare it with the old one, but also just to, it's really done really well. I don't think there's anything about it that I really didn't care for. It's a great movie.
Well, there's always the really, really bad processed shot.
Right.
That's the only thing that really dates this movie. Even the, you know, him drugging his wife.
Well, okay.
You could probably get away with that in a movie today if you established early on that she has a tendency to fly off the handle and be overdramatic and they can't draw attention to themselves.
Or she has anxiety or something like that. That...
Yeah. But the, you know, Hitch's focus on the rear projection and all that. I understand that they had limited time that they could shoot in Marrakesh because Ramadan was coming. And because of that, they didn't want outsiders interfering with the religious observance. But I enjoyed this movie more now as an adult than I think I did as a little boy. As a little boy, I related to the child who gets kidnapped. And now it's been long enough that I relate to the father.
Yeah.
I'm sure I am older than Jimmy Stewart was in that movie, which is just crazy because Jimmy Stewart has always seemed old to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, there were two or three moments that were just so, so, so good and well directed. And you know how the stories always talk about Hitchcock. He had created the movie in his mind. And he would only shoot the shots that he needed as like puzzle pieces for how he was going to edit it all together in his mind. So there wasn't a lot of deleted stuff. There wasn't a lot of alternate takes and things that got trimmed out and he changed his mind. To Hitchcock, the actual making of the movie was secondary to the envisioning it in his head and developing the script and coming up with the dialogue and sort of coming up with a framework for a perfect movie. And he was always disappointed when it came time to make the movie because it would fall short of his expectations in his head. And I watched the making of this, and the director of photography had never worked with Hitchcock before. He was a young man. He had been recommended by another guy that Hitch had worked with a bunch of times. And at one point they were shooting and Hitchcock didn't say anything. And so he went over to him and he said, "Hitch, are you all right?" And Hitch said, "Yeah, that was fine." And he says, "Well, you seem like you're distracted. What went wrong in that scene?" And he said, "Oh, nothing." And he's like, "Well, what is it that's on your mind?" And he said, "Oh, I'm planning out my next movie." And he was on the set shooting this movie and planning out his next one. That sort of stuff is, you know, it's a genius at work, I guess. It's really fun to, there are interviews with Hitchcock because, you know, he died in 1980, which is relatively recently. So there are times when people would sit down with him and talk him through certain things. And the François Truffaut interviews are really fascinating. And a lot of those they actually filmed or, you know, videotaped. So you can watch Hitch just talk about the various things throughout his career. And he made so many movies. And it's just, it's kind of wonderful. Like my niece, I'm always talking about the generation gap between her and me because she was born in 2000. But she likes Hitchcock too. And we would talk about his influence. And I lent her this book about Hitchcock that I read that just talked about, you know, his many frustrations with filmmaking and as he got older and older, how he was unappreciated. But today in the 21st century, he is so appreciated. And seeing a movie like this, you can see why. It was just a masterpiece. But I don't think people usually say The Man Who Knew Too Much is one of Hitchcock's best films. And in fact, when it came out in 1956, a lot of people, the critics rather, compared it unfavorably to the 1930s version, which they said was much tighter. And they said that a lot of the comedy in the first movie was absent in this one. And some of the scenes that people loved, like the dentist scene, was not in this one to its detriment.
Yeah, I read a couple of those reviews too. And I get their point. That dentist scene was really good in the first movie, but it had already been done. And it was kind of nice to see some different things in this movie. You know, there's important things like the Albert Hall scene and stuff like that that you can't really get away from. Those are the focal points of the movie, but some of the steps along the way can change. And the only thing I feel that is missing from this movie, the 1956 version, that definitely played a big part in the earlier movie, was that Peter Lorre made a really good villain. And in this movie, the villain's kind of underplayed, you know. I mean, yes, the Draydons took their son and they were holding him hostage and they were part of this evil plot. But even the ambassador that was the mastermind behind it all, you know, he wasn't this evil villain figure that you really felt the menace of. You know, he was just this political guy that wanted to kill the prime minister. Where in the earlier movie, you have Peter Lorre, who's just, you know, a wonderful villain and very mysterious and strange and interesting to watch. And you don't really have that in this movie. It's more about the plot and the MacGuffins and the set pieces and things like that. But I loved it. But I did. The only thing I really missed was having that evil villain. I guess you have that with the assassin. I can't, you know his name, but I can't think of his name, but.
Reginalder. Yeah, he's an Austrian actor. And I mean, he's just, he's got a frightening face, but the part that Peter Lorre plays in that first movie, there's not really an equivalent character in this because there is the mastermind, but he doesn't do much. And there is the assassin and there is the Dr. Drayton, or Mr. Drayton, I don't know if he was a doctor. A lot of times in a suspense or action movie, your hero is only as good as the villain. But yeah, I didn't really miss that in this one. There was just so much more going on. They gave the wife so much to do as well. Plus those songs, too, which I thought was really neat.
And I really did like the Mrs. Drayton, where she, you know, at the end, she went against her husband in the whole plot. She's like, no, you can't kill this boy. And so she wanted him to survive. So that was kind of a neat addition to this as well, to have her on their side at the end. You were saying that this isn't viewed as maybe one of the top five Hitchcock movies. And, you know, there's so much competition. There's so many good movies that he's done. I see that. But this is definitely one of my favorite movies. You know, I've never ranked them, but, you know, I'm a big Jimmy Stewart fan. I'm a big Hitchcock fan. So, you know, any of these movies that combine those two are pretty good. You know, would I say that this movie is better than Vertigo would be pretty tough because they're just totally different movies and there's a different vibe to each of them. But I would think those three movies, Vertigo, Rear Window, and The Man Who Knew Too Much, are probably three of my favorite. I mean, again, you have Psycho, you have North by Northwest, and so many other great ones. But yeah, those three are always prominent in my mind of favorite Hitchcock movies. I liked Rope, but it's not up there with the rest of them for sure.
Yeah, I agree. Anyway, that I think we've gone on way, way, way too long. But I love that we can talk this in depth about a movie that is, what, 66 years old? And I'm glad that I got to see it again. It had been long enough that I had forgotten a big chunk of the movie. Yeah, oh my gosh, I love Jimmy Stewart. I've seen so many of his movies just in like the last 5 years because I had avoided most of the Westerns. And that's primarily what he did after the war, is he would do Westerns. And so, I mean, I've always been a big fan. I wouldn't be surprised if we end up reviewing another one of them sometime. And we'll definitely do more Hitchcock.
Yeah, and we have one movie left, right? We have Rear Window with Jimmy Stewart in it. That's the fourth movie that we haven't reviewed yet. So at some point, we'll get to that one. But I get we should probably...
get to Wasp Woman. You're absolutely right.
Give Hitchcock a break for a little bit. And come back to it maybe fresh after talking about some other movies. So yes, come back and join us next time when we review The Man Who Knew Too Little, the 1997 Bill Murray movie.
Did you see that when it came out?
I saw it on video, like not too long after it came out.
See, that one had this absolutely wonderful ad campaign where, do you remember it? Where Bill Murray came out and he looked at the camera and he says, "Hi, I'm Bill Murray, and I've got a movie coming out called The Man Who Knew Too Little. And this movie is a really, really good one, and I want you to come and see it. In fact, I guarantee that you will enjoy this movie or your money back." And he says, "You can't write me and you can't contact me to get your money back. But if you see me on the street and you did not like this movie, I will put money in your hand. You have my guarantee." And then the trailer continued. And I was like, wow, okay, I'm going to go see that. I'm sure I saw it opening week. And I remember that ad campaign, but I don't remember The Man Who Knew Too Little because it was really, really forgettable.
Well, that's funny. Yeah, because I was just setting that up as a joke. But yeah, that's interesting. We don't know what we're going to talk about next time, but I'm sure it'll be either a really good movie or a really bad movie. If you want to talk to us about this episode or any other episode, or give us suggestions for what you'd like us to talk about of a PG-13 movie or lower, or you can email at journeyintopodcast@gmail.com. You can call the voicemail line at 77JINTO107. You can make suggestions at journeyinto on Twitter. I think you can find me on journeyinto on Facebook as well. If you'd like to contribute to the podcast and give us a little extra incentive, you can go to patreon.com/journeyinto. If you'd like to support Rish on his podcast, you can go to patreon.com/rishoutfield. And we'd love to hear from you, and we'd love to have your support. Thanks for showing up. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Spread the word if you're enjoying these episodes. Thanks, Rish, for joining me for another Hitchcock review. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, is it too late to change the name of the podcast to The Podcast That Knew Too Much?
Oh, I like that.
Hey, thank you for dedicating yet another entire night to hanging out with me and talking about movies. Hopefully we will get this done again very soon.
Well, have a good night, and we'll talk to you next time.
Whatever will be, will be.
Que sera, sera. Thank you.
will I be?
Now, I'm begging you, if you'll just follow the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License, I won't tell anyone about this. Joe and I will get on an aeroplane and go right back to America. If you don't sell the audio or change it, I won't need to give my wife any more sedatives. You need to let people know where the audio came from. And I need to get my boy, Hank. I don't want to threaten you, but if you cannot meet these conditions, you will have an unfortunate encounter with Reggie Nalder.
I remember in the picture, The Man Who Knew Too Much, we were doing a scene in London's Albert Hall, and I was to chase Doris Day up the stairs while the London Symphony was playing, and I had to say a lot of words during that chase up the stairs, and it was a long speech, and it sort of cleared up a lot of the story, too, and I'd worked hard on those words. And on action, I chased after Doris and just talking my head off. And at the end of the scene, Hitch said, cut, and he said, let's do that again. You were talking so loud, I couldn't hear the London Symphony. He says, as a matter of fact, let's just cut the whole speech. You just follow Doris and look tense. Well, I argued about that. I considered the speech important. But he insisted that the words interfered with the music, which was more important. Now, when you work with Hitch, you don't try doing a scene two ways. You do it one way. His.
They asked their mother.